I'm going to start on an entirely new topic now, how bosons and fermions are described in statistical physics. If there are any leftover questions from old topics, I'll try to deal with them if you want to ask them, or any questions about anything. Okay, what's the second quantized description? This is exactly where you were in the field theory course, I guess, at least the Fermi version of a second quantized description. It is in effect Monday morning. Monday morning, I got to get myself going. You probably have to get yourselves going, so I'll read for a bit to get me going. The classical description, using an ordinary wave function in a quantum description, we base everything on the particle. We say something like the seventh particle is sitting right in front of right here. Particle 23 has its wave function localized over there. It has a wave function psi. There's another particle with a wave function phi. And that's how we describe ordinary quantum system. However, if we have a degenerate quantum system, that is one composed of identical particles, sufficiently squeezed together so that their wave functions overlap, you have to do something entirely different. You can no longer talk about the behavior of individual particles. Individual particles just don't exist anymore. We can only specify how many particles are doing this thing or that thing. Thus, we start out with a description in terms of the possible modes of the system and talk about their occupation. In this kind of description, we would say that there are seven particles in mode 3 and none in mode 2. There's a break here. That is, what I say here is not necessarily very closely related to what I said in the previous paragraph. To discuss independent excitations in degenerate quantum theory, we use a formulation in which we allow the number of excitations to vary. That means if we identify excitations with particles, that we're varying the number of particles. So instead of using e to the minus beta h as our basic formulation and keeping the number of particles fixed, we use as our basic formulation e to the minus beta h minus mu n. Mu is called the chemical potential. And we're allowing the number of particles to vary. The e to the minus beta h, as you know, is called the canonical ensemble. This is called the grand canonical ensemble, and is the one we'll follow in this particular part of the sequence of lectures. So the first thing we got to do is set up the modes. Sounds just like the like where you've been in the field theory course. And it is indeed exactly the same thing. So let's do it anyhow. So to describe a degenerate quantum situation, we first specify the modes. We imagine placing everything in a box with side L. One neat formulation has periodic boundary conditions. The different modes of excitation are described by wave functions, which are the form e to the ik dot r, or e to the ip dot r divided by h bar. It's the same thing. The wave number k, which is three components, must be of the form m times 2 pi over l, so that if we move any one of these coordinates, x, y, or z, through a distance l, the wave function repeats itself. This gives periodic wave functions, and what's more important, it gives a complete set of wave functions. Corresponding to these k's are the momenta p of the form p is h bar k. You could use for formulation any complete set of wave functions, but this is the most convenient for most purposes. In the quantum mechanics of non-interacting particles, each mode is dynamically and statistically independent of the others. That is to say, the Hamiltonian is a sum of terms referring to different modes. We're going to be talking almost, mostly in this section, the chapter 6 of the notes, we're going to be talking mostly about non-interacting particles. By the at the end, we'll come to weakly interacting particles. If we have non-interacting particles in the Hamiltonian, is a sum of terms referring to different modes. We have a discrete infinity of modes labeled by these m's. And so when we do a sum over modes, we're doing a sum over the m's. M is a three-component vector of integers, mx, my, mz. Mx is 0 plus or minus 1 plus or minus 2. Usually, we'll see a counterexample, but not always, many terms contribute from such a sum so that we can write it as the sum over m. When you convert it into a sum over lots of terms, it then becomes an integral over k with a coefficient l over 2 pi cubed. That is precisely the connection indicated here. And then that becomes L over 2 pi cubed times the integral over p. P is a three-component momentum. The result is interpreted by saying the quantum sum over m goes into a sum over phase space in discrete pieces of size L. I'll get you a sec. I'll get to the end of this, and then I'll get back to you. Of course, there's no H cubed in any sensible formulation of classical mechanics, so something funny will have to happen in doing the classical limit. Yes, please.
Do you mind just explaining why the sum over m turns into?
I don't mind. So it's on hold. I'm not sure I can do it on Monday morning. That's another story, but I don't mind at all. Okay, is. Let's do it for one component since then I won't have to write vector symbols. K is now kx. It must be of the form 2 pi over L times m. We start out, we do a sum over m. We do a sum over m times a delta m, where delta m is the spacing between terms. Delta m is 1. But that converts directly into an integral dm. Then we do what we've been doing since we were in sort of grade school. We do grade school quantum mechanics. Dm is dk times L over 2 pi. The only sophisticated thing is writing that delta m in there. Yes?
That's when we're doing, usually when we turn a sum, an infinite sum to an integral, that's sort of the spacing between, like that's when we go to the classical limit.
It depends on what you're doing.
Yeah.
Let's describe photons for a second. Photons, for the cavity, they've got modes. Light, how do you label the modes of light?
Frequency.
Well, yeah. And then the wave number, the number of waves that fit into the cap, that's k. The great insight of, I guess it was Planck, maybe Einstein, I've forgotten exactly who, was that you could convert that wave factor of h-bar into a momentum. But we start out from the view that at least that particular kind of mode is described by m and k. There are other modes which we'll talk about which are more neatly described by p's. And then k, the inside of quantum mechanics is that there's also an m that describes. There's also a k and an m that describes. This is sort of mislabeled. I guess I'm talking about Fabrias. Old stuff. This is Enrico Fermi. If you look carefully at the original photograph, I guess it's not a, yes, there's an alpha here and it's raw. Fermi was being a joker. He put things on the blackboard which are incorrect for this photograph. They cut out the wrong stuff for the postage stamp. I can't resist mentioning that the University of Chicago had this blackboard in its possession up until a couple of years ago. A couple of years ago, they gave it away to a donor who gave the university a pile of money. The donor is still engaged in important discussions with his family as to whether he'll put up the blackboard in his family room or a plasma TV. Such is the way the world is going. And there are the lessons to be learned from this, but I've told you enough. Okay, for the grand canonical formulation, the only difference between bosons and fermions is the possible value of the excitation numbers of a given type, M. That is, in the grand canonical formulation, as we will do it, if you start writing down the fields involved, their commutation relations, of course, are different. N, which is the occupation number of a given mode, can, for bosons, be any non-negative integer, 0, 1, 2, etc. For fermions, N can be only 0 or 1. Either the state is empty or occupied. In either the boson or the Fermi case, the probabilities are proportional to an exponential of epsilon minus mu times N with coefficient 1 over kT and appropriate normalizations. This is a 1. It's analogous to our one particle description, analogous to what we did with P squared over 2m plus u of r. But now, instead of talking about one particle, we focus our attention on one mode, that mode with energy epsilon, and because we have a particle connected with it, having a chemical potential mu that goes with that particle. So we look at a single mode of excitation. For the fermion, what you get to make this thing correctly normalized is you sum of this expression over n is 0 and 1, and you get a normalizing factor, which makes that sum equal to 1. That normalizing factor is called C, and it is of the form 1 plus an exponential of minus beta epsilon minus mu. To deal with grand canonical ensembles, what you have to recognize is that wherever you saw epsilon before, you have epsilon minus mu, epsilon being the energy of the excitation. So if you use this formulation and calculate the probability that n is going to be equal to 1, that's also the same thing as the expectation value of n. The expectation value of n is the sum of n over with the appropriate probabilities over n equals 0 and 1. The only term that comes is that is non-zero is the n equals 1 term. Expectation value of n calculated from this is 1 plus the exponential of beta epsilon minus mu. The probability for finding the state empty is 1 minus n, and flips the sign here of what you get. Oh, I can't resist. This Fermi distribution was, of course, in part invented by Fermi. This thing on here is to remind us that Fermi put together the first nuclear pile and brought in the age of nuclear weapons. Oh, yes.
So what exactly is the chemical potential?
Okay. What exactly is the temperature? Same question. The temperature is exactly defined by the statement that if you change something that changes the energy, you get a change in probability, which is e to the minus the energy change divided by kT. It's a formal definition, but another way of saying it is that if you have two systems in equilibrium, their propensity, big long word, their desire, their wish to give up energy is going to be measured by the temperature, and they will have equal willingness to give up energy if their temperatures are the same. And a chemical potential is very much the same thing. You put this in contact with that. If the chemical potentials are the same, then the net flow of a given kind of material, of particle, between the two things would be zero. If the chemical potential of this guy is higher, you'll have a flow going in that direction. The chemical potential of this guy is higher, you'll have a flow going in the other direction. It is defined by, as we did at the end of the very last hour, a change in probability is proportional to the change in the number of particles times the chemical potential. Up in the next one. A change in probability occurs when you change the number of particles, and if you keep the energy fixed, it's e to the minus beta mu. I'm sorry, there's a formal definition, but it is really the only definition we have.
But I mean, what could it be caused by? Like, is it typically electromagnetic energy that's causing?
I understand your question. It's a good question. If you increase, let's have a particle with charge E. Now, I'm going to get into all kinds of trouble with science. I don't spell very well either, I'm going to get into all kinds of trouble with science. When I can't spell something, I write it out so you can't exactly read it. I will be be a little bit imprecise in my language so you can't tell the sign I'm talking about. But if you have an electron and you change the electrical potential in the neighborhood of the electron by an amount by a certain amount, then the chemical potential changes by the same amount multiplied by the charge on the electron. However, you can change the chemical potential in other ways. This is an energetic way. If you squeeze electrons together so that they have a high pressure, the chemical potential changes. The chemical potential goes up. Anything which makes electrons want to get out of the material will change the chemical potential. So, from the point of view of doing statistical mechanics, we use a handy-dandy rule which has e to the minus beta mu. Rather, the handy-dandy rule is wherever you store energy, you replace it by energy minus mu. The question of what is it really is a deep question. I've done as well as I can. But Sue Coppersmith, when she arrives to lecture here, will tell you that I don't understand any thermodynamics. Sue's an old friend. She knows what I don't understand and don't understand. And the chemical potential is indeed a concept better understood by chemists than by physicists. Yes?
If we consider two systems in contact, and we define the temperature as maybe at equilibrium, the temperature is the same, means that the flow of energy is the same in both directions. And we define the chemical potential to be the same, means the flow of matter is the same. Which means, doesn't mean that if you go to the specific limits, the chemical potential and temperature are the same.
No, no, no. The temperature talks about the flow of energy.
Yeah.
The chemical potential talks about flow of particles of a given type. So I'll have a chemical potential for electrons. I'll have a chemical potential for protons. I'll have another chemical potential for neutrons. All three chemical potentials are necessary to describe what is called a neutron star, which has in it electrons and protons and neutrons floating around. And then, in addition, I need a temperature, which tells us about how the system absorbs and gives up energy. Every conserved quantity, in fact, has in it a parameter which describes that conserved quantity. For example, occasionally I write down the velocity and tell you that if the system is moving with that velocity, there's a term P dot V. You get, instead of E energy, P dot V, some sign or another, but it's nice as 1/2 mv². And in addition, you get mu multiplying nothing, but that mu tells you about how many particles there are. Beta out in front tells you about how the system. This tells you about how the system eats and spits out particles. This tells you about how the system eats and spits out energy. Okay. Now I have to tell you, or rather I will tell you, about how the system, how the occupation numbers in the system depend upon the chemical potential and the temperature. I still have one mode described by epsilon minus mu divided by kT. This is a plot stolen from Wikipedia. Stolen from Wikipedia. Plotting the density, plotting the expectation value of N versus epsilon over mu. At three different temperatures. This yellow line that I can't read so nicely is the kT is equal to mu. This one is kT equals mu over 2. This is kT equals mu over 10. And this one is kT is mu over 100. At low temperatures, that's what this thing is. At low temperatures, this tells you as you vary epsilon, how the occupation number varies. So imagine varying epsilon and thinking about the average, thinking about the average N. For small epsilon, the state is fully occupied, until we come to epsilon equals mu, in which case there's a sharp drop to being empty. On the other hand, if we are at much higher temperatures, as represented by the yellow line here, there is a much more gentle dependence on epsilon. That is, if the system doesn't have any fully occupied, no epsilon system have fully occupied configurations, and it takes a long time for this to die away at high values of the energy. The extreme quantum limit is given by this blue-green curve. The extreme classical limit says that the one in the expectation value of N is 1 over 1 plus E to the beta epsilon minus mu. That's what's being plotted here. But for 1, it doesn't matter. It is E to the beta epsilon minus mu, or that N is proportional to the exponential minus beta epsilon minus mu. That's the extreme classical limit. So we understand, I think, both limits. And this picture tells you what happens. Rapid variation in the neighborhood of epsilon equals mu in the low temperature limit and the high temperature limit, a much more gentle variation, which then turns out to have this term dominating the behavior. I'm going to be talking somewhat more about multiple modes in a sec. I wanted to talk about the behavior of bosons. Once again, we have the probability of observing N being proportional to the constant of proportionality called 1 over C, E to the minus beta epsilon minus mu times N. However, in this case, we have N being all possible non-negative integers. That means, to do the normalization right, we sum up over all possibilities. This is N equals 0, N equals 1, N equals 2, too many plus signs there, N equals 3, and so forth. Finally, we get something which we can sum up using a geometric series, and this normalization is 1 over 1 minus the exponential of beta epsilon minus mu. In order for this to make sense, this quantity must be positive, so that epsilon minus mu must be positive. That's a sort of restriction on the possible values of mu. Mu must be bigger than the smallest value of the energy. This kind of thing is named after Bose and Einstein. The scuttlebutt—that's a word you don't know, some of you. The rumor among historians is that Bose got less credit than he deserved, and Einstein more credit. Hence, I kept the pictures of Bose and no pictures of Einstein on this thing. The average occupation is obtained by taking this, multiplying by N, and summing over N. When you do that, you get this expression for the average value of N. 1 over the exponential of beta epsilon minus mu minus 1. I want you to notice that if you let epsilon minus mu approach its extreme small value, that is, as it approaches the value 0, this exponential becomes 1. That quantity then becomes a small positive number. This 1 over becomes 1 over a small positive number. And the average occupation gets very, very large. We'll talk about that more in a minute. So this is the extreme quantum limit in which epsilon minus mu approaches 0 from above. In that limit, one mode can have lots and lots of quanta in it. These things are described as quanta of the mode. You can even have macroscopic occupation of a single mode. This N may be comparable in the total number of particles in the system, as the N is the lowest mode, may be comparable in the total number of particles in the system. And then we have what is called a Bose-Einstein condensation. I'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. The extreme classical limit is the one, once again, in which mu goes to minus infinity, in which this exponential dominates, and this term counts for nothing. When this exponential dominates, the result is the same as in the Fermi case. We can neglect the 1 and on, and in the extreme classical limit, all that matters is e to the minus beta epsilon minus mu. You notice that in that limit, beta mu serves as a, e to the minus beta mu serves as a sort of normalizing factor. And the mu then describes how many particles you have in a given state. Bosons need not be conserved. We'll just talk for a moment about photons. Photons are described in exactly the same way, except that because photons aren't conserved, they're created, they're annihilated. This mu doesn't exist. This mu is a reflection of a conservation law of the number of Wechsler forms. And in the case of photons, if you replace Wechsler forms by photons, then there is no conservation law and there is no mu. It looks like mu equals zero. Okay, that's exactly what's up on this slide. I'm slightly apologetic about all of this. Many of you, about half of you, have seen roughly this stuff before. However, you need it, and I want to make sure that you've all seen it. There was stuff last time, for example, Boltzmann's derivation of entropy increase, which relatively few of you, maybe none of you, have seen before. One example, the first example studied in detail of a boson excitation is provided by a set of waves. We're about to cross out the one mode stuff and start talking about lots of waves, lots of modes. There are two main examples which we study. One is light waves and the other is sound waves. Sound waves are called phonons, and they're important excitations in materials. The light waves you know about their importance. I'm not sure this is the first time I've used the word excitation in this course. The great map that takes you from field theory, particle physics, or for that matter, string theory, to everyday quantum mechanics, to statistical physics, to condensed matter physics, is the word excitation. In both cases, we're looking at a background behavior called vacuum in one situation, and called equilibrium statistical mechanics in another. And that background, you then describe what happens above that background, and that thing above the background is an excitation. The Hamiltonian for a bunch of photons, a bunch of light waves, or indeed for photons, is given by the energy of that excitation times the number of excitations. And the statistical mechanics is given by writing down this Hamiltonian. Sorry for the shift in fonts. This Hamiltonian, which depends on the number of excitations in each mode and then summing over modes. For some reason, which is pretty silly, I've seen we've used a J here and an M before to describe the modes. The modes are described by a vector M, which then tells you what the modes are in the cavity. Epsilon J is the energy of a single excitation of type J, and NJ is the number of excitations of that type. These quanta have the property that they are not conserved. That's why there's no mu. When the basic objects under consideration are conserved, we put a mu in. That is, for example, when they're bosons, atoms and molecules, like helium, ordinary everyday helium, superscript 4 is a boson. If we imagine non-interacting version of helium atoms, gas, for example, we would then have a situation in which you would have a Bose description with a chemical potential. Here we have no chemical potential. We can define the total number of excitations as the sum over J of Nj, but that definition is of a quantity which varies in time. Okay, I'm about to describe to you the beginnings of quantum statistical mechanics as it occurred in the description of photons in a cavity. As everybody knows, the one place that classical mechanics fell on its nose was in the description of a black body. You take a box, you put it at temperature T, and you put a little hole in it. That box then begins to contain photons because the walls of the box emit and absorb photons. You want to describe it by statistical mechanics. You want to observe it by watching the photons coming out. You want to describe it by statistical mechanics. And here we go. You first of all describe one mode. We have, in fact, already done this description of one mode. You have a normalization factor. You have the normalization factor has this structure. Same mistake with putting in too many plus signs exists in this equation as existed in the equation two slides ago. You may expect that I use cut and paste in order to reproduce my mistakes. But the equation is essentially correct. The average energy in the mode is n times epsilon. Epsilon is the energy of a single photon. It is h bar omega, which is epsilon over e to the minus beta epsilon minus 1. The classical limit is a high temperature limit. In that high temperature limit, what we do is we say that beta times epsilon is small. Exponential, then, of a small number is that number, 1 plus that number. And then in that limit, we have n times epsilon is 1 over beta times kT. This is a, you remember the rule in the classical limit for harmonic oscillators, is 1/2 kT for every quadratic degree of freedom. One quadratic, you have two quadratic degrees of freedom, one involving potential, the other involving kinetic, for every mode in the cavity. Hence, you have a kT per mode. Hence, when we sum over all the modes of the cavity, going up to m equals infinity, we have an infinite energy. And indeed, an infinite amount of infinite energy per unit area of the whole per unit time coming out. That's a big embarrassment for classical mechanics. One of the major things that killed off classical mechanics is that this argument in the classical limit gives n epsilon is kT. Of course, it isn't called n epsilon in that. It gives n epsilon is equal to kT. The cavity has the infinite number of modes, therefore the infinite energy. That's a terrible thing to happen, to have a physics be produce an infinity. You've had discussions of infinity in your field theory course. I'm not going to say whether infinities are infinitely wicked or just wicked, but they do give theoretical physicists bad dreams. Yes?
Why is there an infinite number of modes in the cavity?
Because, again, I'll draw a one-dimensional picture. There's a wall at zero, there's a wall at L. I have a wave which fits into the box. Doesn't fit into the box, so I'll move the wall. There's the wall, right there. Nope. There's the wall, right there. I have a wave that fits into the box. I could draw sine waves with more wiggles that fit into the box. I could draw a sine wave with an infinite number of, almost infinite number of wiggles that fit into the box. Depending on how fast I can move my chalk, I can get it, I can get M as high as I like, I can get K as high as I like, I can get omega as high as I like, and therefore I get lots and lots and lots of modes. This is a real embarrassment for me.
Each one of those?
Each one of those has, each mode has a KT in it. Let me emphasize the reality of that. This slide, now let's go to the next slide. So here's the analysis of photons in a qubit cavity. There are two modes of polarization of a photon, as you know. The photon has to have its polarization vector perpendicular to its direction, and that means it has two independent polarizations. The Hamiltonian is a sum over m, the different wave vectors, or the integers that go with the different wave vectors, the two different modes of polarization, h bar c times k. H bar times k is momentum. Multiply that by a c, you get energy for a massless particle. M, which I'm using here because the particle is massless, describes the state of excitation. And this sum goes over each component of m is 0, plus or minus 1, plus or minus 2, up to infinity. We can then find the average value of the energy as the sum over n, m, of n. As a wicked person, I did the wrong thing here. Okay. Imagine the right answer is that we have twice the sum over m of the occupation times h bar ck, which depends on m. This n is also e to the minus beta h, but this thing up here doesn't belong. Or we could write it without this and including that. Either way, we get a sum over m of the energy in each mode times the occupation number of the modes times 2 for the two polarizations. My apologies for the error. I can fix it up, I guess. Let me try. Nah, I'll say it again. It's easier than fixing it on the slide. Either this term doesn't belong or this term doesn't belong. They are the same thing. And they don't belong at the same time. The correct formula is, for example, this one, in which the sum over m is converted to an integral over wave vector times l over 2 pi cubed times that 2 times an integral dk h bar ck exponential minus 1. This is the occupation. This is the energy of a single guy. This combination of factors is the sum over m, and there's the polarization. I can then make the integration thing dimensionless by using the variable beta h bar ck, which I'll call q, as my integration variable, and I come up with this answer. Now, this form of the integration is perfectly finite. At small q, this denominator is proportional to q, but we get a dq to the fourth power. So the integral converges when at the low end. At the high end, the exponential makes it converge. It costs a lot of energy to produce a single photon of high 5K or high Q. And that large constant energy means that the occupation number, this occupation number, is very small. That's the effect which is not taken into account in classical mechanics. That's the effect which makes this integral infinite in classical mechanics. In classical mechanics, you have you're always working in the small q limit, and that doesn't, that's not right. And so this calculation provides a start for the age of quantum mechanics. Okay, now we have fermions in a box. This is the original papers on fermions in a box, at least on fermions. In metal, electrons act as independent quasiparticles. Quasiparticles is a new word for you, at least for some of you. New word in the course, I bet. New word at Waterloo. Quasiparticle means an excitation which behaves like a particle. I will make noises about that next time, lots of noises about that. In a metal, electrons behave as independent particle-like excitations with an energy-momentum relation in which E is a function of the momentum of the quasiparticle. The quasiparticle is then given in terms of wave vectors as written down for the general excitations. Now, here's the picture we had. This is the picture we had before. In a metal, the picture looks very much like the blue-green curve that I can't see, but you probably can. That is one in which the occupation goes from 1 at lower energies to 0 at higher energies. So most of the electrons in a metal are doing nothing much. They're just sitting there. The electrons that have energy, there's a right way of saying it. That's not what I want to say. Most of the modes in a metal are doing nothing much. They're just sitting there. They're either empty, way up here, or fully occupied, and nothing is happening, way down there. That kind of thing was Dirac's interpretation of his original equation. And indeed, it what happens in a degenerate Fermi-Dirac systems. It's only the few particles on this near this edge of the Fermi Sea. This thing down here in the blue-green stuff, it's called the Fermi Sea. It is a gas of interactions, which gas of excitations, which remain filled, but nothing much is happening. These quasi-particles behave very much like particles. In particular, their velocity is given by the gradient p of their energy. And this velocity can be measured by looking at the motion of the excitations through the system. Only the electrons with energies close to the chemical potential, which we call in this context the Fermi energy, play an important role in moving heat and particles through the system. The electrons near the Fermi energy, and that is the particles in the region near the Fermi energy, and in fact, the unoccupied states called holes in the region just below the Fermi energy, the electrons near the Fermi energy are said to be close to the top of the Fermi Sea. For lesser energies, way down here, within the sea, the electrons can't do much. However, you can notice the absence of electrons, the holes in the excitations here. For some materials, for example, aluminum metal, epsilon is p squared over 2m, or rather p squared over 2m star, where m star is an effective mass, represents a good approximation. For these materials, the Fermi C form forms a ball with radius, certain radius. The radius is called pf for the Fermi momentum. Yes, thank you.
Why can't we just think of them as normal particles? What's different?
Okay. For aluminum, they are very much like normal particles. However, in other metals, they behave funny. For aluminum, as I said, the shape of the Fermi surface is a sort of ball. For, I can't draw any of them. There are other materials, for instance, this is aluminum. I will give a funny version of the shape of the Fermi surface, the barium. Barium sort of repeats itself like that. And in fact, repeats itself up here. We have the basic ball right there, but the ball is connected by bridges to others, to periodic reflections of that ball. This is a periodic system, and P is the same as P plus 2 pi L divided by H bar.
That's right.
In any, no, sorry, not right. Okay, let me say it anyhow. You can get many different configurations of the Fermi surface. The one that is most particle-like is this ball-like, which occurs in aluminum. This bunch of almost spheres connected by bridges, which occurs in, for example, barium, is a very different configuration. In both cases, the motion of the excitation is quite different from the x motion that you get for a particle. If you start with an excitation here in aluminum, and you do gentle things to it, like applying a magnetic field, it tends to go around this Fermi surface. If you do the same thing in barium, it tends to go along this Fermi surface. Here, if you look at the velocities, the average velocity is zero and it gets no place at all. Here, the average velocity is non-zero, and it in fact travels through a large distance. The behavior of these two things are different. They're both described, however, equally by giving an energy which depends on momentum. A different dispersion relation, different energy-momentum relation for the materials. We call them quasi-particles because although they have an energy-momentum relation, they do not have the free particle energy-momentum relation.
Is the momentum here the particle momentum or the crystal momentum?
both. That is, what I failed to write down was a description of the Umflat processes, in which I, without using the jargon, was a description of the change in momentum, which has no change at all. And in fact, there's a periodic behavior in momentum. And this thing isn't one sphere, it's a whole bunch of spheres arranged periodically. There's a periodic behavior in barium. So would P can be either interpreted as the value sitting right there or the value sitting at the peak repeated what's one description versus the other description. Now, there's nobody that you've already guessed. I told you that Sue could say that I didn't know any thermodynamics. There's nobody that can tell you better than you know yourself that I'm not the world's best solid-state physicist. I do it, or have done it, but I clearly don't have a researcher's knowledge of solid-state physics. I do other things within condensed matter physics. So I told you something about what happens to the shape of these excitations, but it's not very professional. However, let me tell you then, since I was going to, since you asked me to do so, let me then tell you about these excitations. At low temperatures, that is temperatures that are lower in comparison to the Fermi energy, in metals, the behavior of the electrons is the behavior of independent particles. Independent particles with a funny energy momentum relationship. These things are called quasi-particles, and they behave essentially according to the laws of classical mechanics. For example, in order to represent a potential, you let the single particle energy go into the single particle energy plus potential U. In order to represent a vector potential, you let U times E. You let P go to P minus EA, vector potential divided by C, in electromagnetic units. So that to represent a magnetic field, for example, you might have an epsilon T minus EA over C. These things behave like independent excitations within the system. They are, however, not particles, because in fact, these independent excitations move in a periodic potential. And the periodic potential modifies the energy-momentum relation. Since I'm getting, I guess say that in the field theory, the excitations are also not particles. They are particles all dressed up with interactions, and they are in fact excitations just like this. An electron, for example, in field theory, moving through space, has with it a cloud of phonons and positrons, photons and positrons, and other excitations, and that dressed particle is what we call the electron. In fact, it doesn't have a mass equal to the mass that's in the Lagrangian, because all the dressing changes the mass of the excitation. And that change produces what's called renormalization of mass. This effect is essentially identical in condensed matter physics, except condensed matter physics doesn't have a relativistic invariance to limit the value of epsilon to be p squared, square root of p squared plus c squared. We can have sort of anything in condensed matter physics. And in low temperatures of metals, different metals, we have most anything you might want, and many things you might not want. Let's say everything on this picture. I'd like to see them get some homework assignment like the thing in red. Or to, you go on from there to get the temperature dependence of the density at fixed chemical potential, or even the specific heat at fixed chemical potential. This is something that can be calculated rather directly, and it is something that can do a little homework assignment. Okay. We've now done independent fermions. Pretty good representation of a metal,
pretty good representation of the neutron star, and probably other places, but I can't think of them really. Oh yes, helium-3 gas. The gas fermion helium behaves somewhat in the same time. We'll talk about that more next time. For conserved bosons in a box, at very low temperatures, fluid helium-4, that is boson helium, undergoes a phase transition into a superfluid state in which it can move without viscosity. This is believed to arise because a finite fraction of the entire number of atoms falls into a single quantum mode described by a single wave function. The basic theory of how this occurs is due to Vogel-Yubov. Here is a step called the law of Vogel-Yubov. I can't resist mentioning that as far as I can tell from the net, this is the only picture that exists of Vogel-Yubov. Vogel-Yubov kept away from cameras. Bose-Einstein theory of the phase transition in non-equilibrium, non-interaction boson-liquid, is some pale reflection of the real superfluid transition. I'm going to do the three-dimensional theory of a non-interacting boson-liquid in the next slide. The number of particles per unit volume is, in a Bose system, 1 over L cubed times the average number of excitations described by quantum numbers n summed over m. Epsilon minus mu. Now, at low temperatures, what happens is that each term here, because epsilon is bigger than mu, each term here gets smaller and smaller as the temperature. What am I saying that correctly? I'm not sure that I am saying that correctly. What happens here is that we can't achieve a high density of particles. So from what we would normally like to do, which is to consider this sum to be replaceable by an integral over all the values of p of e to the minus beta p squared of 2 minus beta mu. In fact, what we do is notice that one term in this sum, the m equals 0 term, can be as large as we wish. That term, if epsilon minus mu is small, that term has epsilon equals 0, so if minus mu is small, it has the structure 1 over L cubed, this L cubed, times beta mu. And beta mu can be as small as we wish, so that the contribution to the average density from the zeroth mode can be as large as we want. That is, a single mode can dominate the behavior of a Bose system at low temperatures. In fact, that kind of thing is observed in helium-4, in which at low temperatures goes into a superfluid state. And the superfluid does wonderful things. Let me tell you some wonderful thing that the superfluid does. Imagine you put it in a container shaped like a donut. So this is a donut. And helium is sitting in here. And you started moving it by getting it moving like that. Below the superfluid transition temperature, below the temperature at which one gets one term making a finite contribution to this, below that transition temperature, this motion around the donut will continue indefinitely. The material is said to be a superfluid. And a superfluid can maintain itself in motion indefinitely without any viscous drag, any drag from the walls.
this ability of quantum systems to do wonderful things is, in fact, a very characteristic property of quantum systems. And there are two, then, quite different phases of Bose-Helium. One phase is called the normal phase, in which it behaves pretty much like any other gas or liquid. And the other phase is called the superfluid phase, in which it does all kinds of wonderful things like this. And this isn't just a tiny little effect. It is basically the Bose transition that drives superfluid behavior. However, superconducting behavior is driven by fundamentally the same kind of transition. The electrons come together and form funny kinds of pairs. Those pairs undergo a superfluid transition. And pretty soon, you have a wire, which if you wind it up like this and start sending an electrical current around, the electrical current will continue indefinitely, or at least until we run out of patience. When last I looked, such a wire had been observed to show current flow unabated for a period of a year. That's as much patience as most graduate students have, and they've got to get out. And a year is already a pretty unreasonable time to be doing an experiment. Okay. Yes and no. Keeping it cold is, in real terms, a energy-absorbing process. In an idealized world in which you can take a bottle and suspend it in vacuum and turn off radiation fields, you can keep it cold indefinitely, without costing any energy. In practice, however, what you have to do is you have to have a refrigerator to pump energy out of it, because you can't turn off the radiation fields and other sources of heat. I have another 5 minutes. I'm going to spend my 5 minutes talking about this for a minute, and then I'll come back and finish it up at the in the next hour. I mentioned that helium-3, that is fermion helium, helium which in which the nucleus contains a neutron and two protons, and the outer shell contains two electrons. That has, we count them, 5 particles, and it's a fermion. Fermion helium is observable in nature, and we can look at its energy-momentum relation, and we can describe it in terms of non-interacting excitations. In fact, that description was first done by Landau in the 1950s, I believe. This was the same period as experimentalists, particularly John Wheatley at the University of Illinois in Urbana. Experimentalists were getting helium-3 and observing its behavior. Now, I said that we could describe things for a low-temperature system, and this is a low-temperature system, in terms of quasi-particle theory. What we do to describe it in terms of quasi-particle theory is give it an epsilon of P, R, and T, and say that the number of excitations is described by an F of P, R, and T, and the change in free energy is the change in the number of excitations, like times epsilon, just as if these were free independent particles. And we then continue to use a free particle description. For example, we describe the time dependence of this occupation as the time derivative of F plus the gradient of epsilon in momentum space times the gradient of F in coordinate space minus the gradient of epsilon in coordinate space times the gradient of the distribution function in momentum space is some collision term. I have a collision term written down here. I may just get to it in a moment, but I should tell you more about this. We are then using classical mechanics to describe the left-hand side of this Boltzmann equation. We're using the idea that you can use excitations and that the excitations behave like independent particles obeying standard classical mechanics, except that they have a funny energy-momentum relation. Exactly the same kind of conceptualization is used in particle physics. That is, that the excitations, which we call elementary particles, are described by standard quantum mechanics with energy-momentum relations that we get from relativistic quantities, but masses that we sort of get from the deep guts of the theory. Now, I should write this collision term in a way in which it makes sense in a low-temperature fermion theory. So we have the left-hand side of the Boltzmann equation completely under control. It is like classical mechanics, except that we have a changed energy-momentum relation. The right-hand side of the Boltzmann equation, well, is just the same sort of thing as we had before. Integrals over the possible excitations. That's okay. We're getting. I'll wake up as soon as the hour ends. Integrals over the possible excitations. We have a picture you've seen before in which two excitations with momentum P and Q come together and come out with momentum P prime and Q prime. There is a delta function for the conservation of momentum. These excitations have momentum that is conserved. There's a delta function for the conservation of energy. They have quasi-particle energies which are conserved. And then there is a scattering term. The scattering term, however, looks a little different from the scattering term that we had before. We have a particle with momentum P scattering against a particle with momentum Q. This is F of P, R, and T, but I got lazy about writing the R and T. This is F of Q, R, and T. I got lazy about writing the R and T. However, we can't land in a final state if that final state is occupied. So instead of putting ones here for the probability of landing in the final state, we'll put a 1 minus F of P prime. Instead of putting the 1 there, we might have a 1 minus F of Q prime. In the opposite direction of collision, in which P prime and Q prime goes into P and Q, we have a 1 minus F of P, 1 minus F of Q. Now, where does all this come from? Well, the 1 minus F of P is sort of reasonable. It has a structure that we might have expected on the behavior of independent excitations. Where does it come that at low temperatures we should be able to use this epsilon as it is modified, for example, containing an effective mass, as it is modified by the effect of the interactions between particles? This epsilon of P, R, and T is not the non-interacting epsilon. It's a different quantity. It is a quantity that we have to calculate. But Landau just wrote down this equation. The Soviet style was sort of interesting. As I probably told you, you write down, somebody like Landau would write an equation like that and say something like, as is well known. Well known meant that all of his friends in Moscow had heard it before, at least once. As is well known, you could represent a low temperature fermion system in this fashion. That's sort of what there was in the paper. Not much more explanation than that. Also, that's what there is for this part of the thing. However, it works. The experiments that Wheatley and others did on low temperature helium-3 showed the behavior that was here or here, and showed that these equations were right. One of the things that theorists do is extend previously existing theories based upon seat of the pants, based upon feeling about how the extensions should occur. I can say that with confidence because, in fact, you just saw in the last lecture one such extension which turned out to be wrong, which, as you saw, gave minus signs. And as you will see, the minus signs mean that the theory is not consistent. In this case, the extension is right. That is, helium-3 is probably described in this fashion at the temperatures just below, at the millidegree temperatures, millidegree to degree temperatures that the observations were made at. However, we ought to be cautious. We don't know that this theory, as outlined here, will describe fermion helium down to the lowest possible temperatures. It has described fermion helium down to temperatures that we have measured, at least I believe so. I haven't kept up with the most recent literature. However, anything can happen. This is a statement that the ground state of this system, or its the state of this system as described by statistical mechanics, is qualitatively similar to that of a non-interacting system. That could be false. It could become false at lower temperatures. There are other possibilities out there. There is, for example, the behavior called the Luttinger liquid, which is a different behavior and is believed to have been observed, perhaps, in materials that form high-temperature superconductors. We don't know that this seat-of-the-pants extension of the standard Boltzmann equation type thing really works for a given system. We know that it works for some system, but for other systems, it's not going to work. And which systems it works for is a matter for experimental observation or careful theoretical calculation. We don't have the careful calculations, but we do have the experiments that suggest that for Fermi helium, this is a correct set of equations. So next time I pick up from this, I will do the same thing for Bose systems. I will wave my hands around a little bit more about Bose and Fermi stuff, and then I'll go to the qualitative behavior of phase transitions. Questions or comments? OK, thank you.